Hello, this is Mary Rose Cottingham with the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, May 23rd, 2016. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined Vroom with a View, and this was written by Tony Reed from town of Walker. Don Kohler is taking the Start Seeing Motorcycles safety campaign to new heights, about 7 feet to be exact. Drivers zipping up and down U.S. 51 past Kohler's home in the minuscule burg of Walker, south of Macon and north of Milwaukee, can't help but notice his wrecked Harley-Davidson motorcycle lofted betwixt heaven and earth. It's mounted on top of a 7-foot-tall pole above a 30-foot-long, 2.5-foot-tall banner proclaiming the Start Seeing Motorcycles message. That admonition is a safety drive supported by the Illinois Department of Transportation and motorcycle groups such as Abate. The curious who pull off the highway to peer closer at the airborne Road King hog will also see a smaller message propped on the bike itself that says, "Let's work together and teach people to stop and look twice to prevent this." If the truck driver who pulled out in front of Kohler in 2011 had looked twice and started seeing his motorcycle, the 56-year-old man from Walker would be riding his machine instead of spotlighting it on top of a pole. The resulting collision left him close to death with a fractured skull, collapsed lung, multiple broken ribs, a shattered right arm, and a crushed left hip, among sundry other life-altering maladies. Doctors dropped Kohler into a medically induced coma for 20 days while his internal workings were put back together. When he resurfaced, he found he had a steel rod reuniting his right leg and a new fake left hip to replace an original mangled beyond salvage. Kohler, however, was just happy to emerge walking upright and drawing breath, and he considered it part of his renewed lease on life to promote motorcycle safety. "God knew my job wasn't done down here yet," he says. So he spent years hauling his wrecked bike to schools and events to tout the safety message, as well as showing off the chewed-up machine in parades. And then earlier this month, which is Motorcycle Awareness Month, he came up with the bright idea of the elevated Harley, and he plans to leave it in place for several more months to accelerate home the idea of safety awareness. I mean, what better visual could you have to start seeing motorcycles, he asks. Kohler's friend, Jim Heatherton, hopes motorcyclists as well as car drivers take notice. Heatherton is president of the Decatur Chapter of Freedom by Choice Abate of Illinois and is worried by the rise in motorcycle fatalities. In 2015, 146 riders died statewide, a jump of 28 over the previous year. Another worrying trend in accidents is the influence of alcohol and drugs. And it's not just the drivers colliding with motorcyclists who are tipsy. Heatherton says the numbers reveal a disturbing trend of impaired riders and passengers showing up as a factor in fatal crashes. "We want to tell people, hey, you guys are killing yourselves," he adds, saying the rule for all road users is simple if you want to go home again. Don't drive or ride intoxicated. And assuming they are suitably sober, Heatherton says drivers and riders must pay attention and learn to look out for each other. "The biggest killer for getting hit on a bike is some driver making a left-hand turn," he explains. "Make sure you look left and right and left one more time and take that extra second to be sure it's clear. And don't tailgate someone on a bike. Give them the respect and distance you would want someone to give you." Asked if a Harley on a stick will drive any of this safety stuff home, Heatherton said it certainly can't hurt. He believes no one preaches safety more effectively than those who have ridden right up to the edge of dying and managed to come back. "I can't even say just how lucky Don is to be alive," he says. "Now he just wants to get his point across." Our next article is headlined, Sarah Bush Health Center Seeks $31 Million Expansion, from the Lee News Service. Sarah Bush Lincoln Health System has submitted plans to the state to build a new heart center and add 20 medical surgical beds to the hospital. An application for a certificate of need on the $31 million project was submitted to the Illinois Health Facilities and Services Review Board in early May. If approved, the expansion is expected to be built by December 2019. The addition, which is planned for the southeast side of the health center, will span 65,235 square feet. The ground floor will house staff office space, facility and environmental services, and mechanical rooms. The first floor will consolidate cardiac services, including the addition of a second cardiac catheterization lab, 15 examination rooms for the cardiac and pulmonary clinic, rehabilitation gym, stress testing, echo testing pulmonary, EKG, and nuclear medicine. The second floor will house 21 additional medical surgical rooms. However, an existing bed will be lost to construction. The entire addition will be connected to each adjacent floor of the health center, including a new elevator going to the third and fourth floors. Erica Stoller, Director of Planning, explained that through a partnership with Prairie Heart Institute of Illinois, the volume of cardiology services has grown greatly in the last few years. While in calendar year 2013, Sarah Bush performed 514 cardiac cath cases, the number has grown to 889 in calendar year 2015. The cath lab performs diagnostic and interventional cases. It is currently staffed by cardiologist Thomas Cahill and interventional cardiologist Amit Dande. A third cardiologist, Michael Lamonto, will be joining the Heart Center in the fall. Sarah Bush Lincoln also has experienced inpatient growth as well, growing from 3,989 inpatients medical surgical admissions in calendar year 2013 to 4,911 in calendar year 2015. At the same time, the average daily census grew from 53.6 to 61.2. The medical surgical beds are used to care for adults after surgery and for people with general illnesses such as pneumonia and congestive heart failure. The $31 million project will be financed through a bond issuance, cash, pledges, and gifts. If approved by the Health Facilities and Services Review Board, construction would begin in the fall and be completed by December 2019. The addition will feature a drive-up canopied entrance with a glass and metal facade on the west side and brick on the south and east side. Our next article is The General Assembly Has Lots of Work, Little Time, written by Dan Petrella of the Herald and Review Springfield Bureau Chief. Illinois lawmakers and Governor Bruce Rauner enter the waning days of the spring legislative session with much left to accomplish and not much time left to accomplish it. Democratic-controlled General Assembly and the Republican governor have gone nearly a year without agreeing on a budget, and they face a May 31st deadline to pass a spending plan for the fiscal year that begins July 1st. Approving a budget after the end of the month would require three-fifths majorities in the House and Senate, while Democrats have enough members in both chambers to meet the mark on their own. The House supermajority has failed to hold together on several key votes over the past year, and Democrats have been unwilling to vote without Republican support to approve the mix of spending cuts and tax increases both sides agree are needed to balance the budget. Rauner, meanwhile, is still holding out for approval of portions of his turnaround agenda, which he says are needed to improve the state's business climate and ultimately its finances. On top of all that, many Democrats, particularly in the Senate, are still pushing for changes to the way the state distributes money to public schools before next school year. It's not uncommon for the legislature to butt up against or even blow past the budget deadline, said Kent Redfield, an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. But because the state has been operating without a complete budget for the past year, and because Rauner is seeking concessions on core democratic principles, such as collective bargaining rights, it's a much more difficult budget problem than we normally face, Redfield said. It's much more intractable than anything I've ever seen in 40 years of being here in Illinois, he said. There have been some recent signs of bipartisan cooperation, including a bill Rauner signed last month that assured some money for public universities and community colleges, which have been deprived of state funding amid the budget impasse. Lawmakers from both parties also came together to produce a framework for next year's budget that includes $2.4 billion in spending cuts and $5.4 billion in new revenue, in part from raising the personal income tax rate from 3.75% to 4.85%. But the kind of grand bargain that Rahner has been pushing for, which would include balanced budgets for this year and next, along with portions of his agenda, such as changes to workers' compensation laws to make them more business-friendly, appears increasingly unlikely. Rahner and the top four legislative leaders met last week and agreed to budget talks among a bipartisan working group on topics including tax increases and the governor's policy priorities. But House Speaker Michael Madigan, from Chicago, quickly put out a statement calling on Rahner to put aside his agenda that hurts the middle class. Representative Dan Brady, Republican from Bloomington, is one of the lawmakers taking part in those discussions. "We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there," he said. Brady said he believes Rahner acknowledges that he won't be able to get all the changes he wants, but Republicans need to see some changes that will improve Illinois' economic climate. "When we go back, the governor is going to have to be as clear as possible on, if I can get this accomplished and that, that's it, and then I'll talk to you on the revenue side," Brady said. "The real unknown is where the speaker sits." State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie, the number three Democrat in the House, said they've been clear all along. They want a budget that isn't tied to Rahner's agenda. "To put that on the same level as the budget is appalling," Lang said, noting the damage that's been done to higher education and social services as a result of the impasse. Elementary and secondary education is the one portion of this year's budget that has been unscathed, but whether that will be the case next year remains unclear. State Senator Andy Mayner, Democrat from Bunker Hill, sponsored an overhaul of the state's funding formula that was approved in the Senate but hasn't moved into the House. He's been working with some House Democrats on a compromise proposal that's also draws on ideas put forth by State Senator Jason Barrickman, Republican from Bloomington. "There's no piece of legislation of this size and magnitude that is just going to get rubber-stamped by the other chamber," Mayner said. The question remains whether the new plan will get the backing of Madigan and Rahner, who has advocated increasing overall funding for the next year under the existing formula. In our final article from the front page of today's Herald and Review, this was written by Jennifer McDermott, Associated Press, and it's headlined, "Special Court Offers Veterans Opportunity for Rehabilitation." William Delaney, a former Marine, had already served 4 years of probation for an alcohol-related offense in Florida and was back in court, this time in Rhode Island, for driving under the influence. His newest brush with the law, combined with his alcoholism and depression, he feared, could close the door on the rest of his life. That was almost 2.5 years ago. Delaney now mentors other veterans in that same court, and he's working at his master's degree in social work to continue to help vets. The Veterans Treatment Court opened 5 years ago in Warwick, Rhode Island, as the first specialty court in New England to help veterans avoid jail and turn their lives around. Like Delaney, most of the 220 veterans who have completed the program have not committed another offense. The rate of recidivism stands at about 6%, according to the court. "We judge ourselves really harshly in addition to how the court judges us because of how we've fallen," Delaney said. "It's just devastating. Even such a small thing as having a judge smile and say she understands, and having a treatment team that truly cares, it's a spark. It makes you believe that you can do it differently this time." For Delaney, that jurist was Associate Judge Pamela Woodcock Pfeiffer. "She seemed like she cared," said Delaney. "She reminded me of who I could be and who I was. I wasn't the bad guy. I wasn't the lost, drunk person. I could become something better again. That was a life-changing moment." Woodcock Pfeiffer also has kind words for the court and for veterans such as Delaney. "I am totally convinced it's working," Woodcock Pfeiffer said. "People are very clear that if it were not for this, then they would have all these problems." The first Veterans Treatment Court started in 2008 in Buffalo, New York. Similar courts sprang up nationwide as a way to help reform the criminal justice system, lower costs by reducing the prison population and recidivism rates, and connect veterans with treatment programs. Today there are more than 250, and hundreds more are planned, according to Justice for Vets, which advocates for the establishment of the courts and provides training for jurisdictions with new courts. The Rhode Island Court has received hundreds of referrals from the District Court for misdemeanor cases. Veterans can opt to stay in District Court, where their case would likely be resolved faster. If they go to the Veterans Court, they have to follow whatever treatment the court prescribes to address substance abuse, behavioral or other issues, and regularly check in with the court staff, usually for 10 months to a year. At the end, often their case is dismissed entirely and expunged. The court has about 70 active cases. Chief Justice Judge Jean E. LaFazia said the Veterans Court gives people tools to reintegrate into their community. She credits Woodcock Pfeiffer for getting to know the veterans well, which invests them in the process. By the time you get someone in here, they are often at rock bottom, LaFazia said. You're helping them rebuild themselves. It's a remarkable difference. LaFazia and Woodcock Pfeiffer said the state has a duty to help veterans and give them a chance. The court holds graduation ceremonies for veterans who complete treatment. At a recent ceremony, Woodcock Pfeiffer praised the veterans for their hard work and asked them pointed questions about their plans to make sure they would not fall back on old patterns. I hope we've been able to give you hope and the ability to control some of the things that sometimes control you, she said. The veterans were presented with a coin in the style of a military command coin, which is meant to show one's military affiliation and install pride. It bears the last six words of the Pledge of Allegiance, with liberty and justice for all. Our next article in the Decatur Herald and Review comes from page 2. It is headlined, Alabama Official Ethics Trial to Begin, and it's marked from Opelika, Alabama. Shrewd, intelligent, and disciplined, House Speaker Mike Hubbard was the general of the GOP offensive in 2010 to win Republican control of the Alabama legislature, a legislative body that has been under the direction of Democrats since Reconstruction. The 2010 campaigns were bolstered by a series of indictments and scandals involving Democrats, which provided easy campaign fodder for the GOP. After winning Republicans in a victory lap special session, passed sweeping new ethics legislation. Ethics was a subject that set Republicans apart from the Democrats, Hubbard wrote in his book, Storming the State House, about the 2010 campaign. 6 years later, Hubbard will go on trial under that same ethics law on charges that he used his political positions to make money and obtain financial favors from lobbyists and company heads with business before the Alabama legislature. Hubbard faces 23 felony ethics charges accusing him of steering GOP campaign work to his media companies and using his office to obtain employment, investments, and benefits for his companies. Opening statements are expected Tuesday in what's become a season of scandal in Alabama, with a trio of embarrassments facing three top GOP office holders. Alabama Governor Robert Bentley has faced calls for his impeachment following a sex-tinged scandal involving a former top aide. Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore faces possible ouster from office over accusations that he violated canons of judicial ethics by trying to block same-sex weddings, despite the U.S. Supreme Court decision effectively legalizing gay marriage nationwide. At the center of it is the case against Hubbard. The high-profile corruption trial will bring a roster of the state's political and corporate elite into an Opelika, Alabama courtroom as prosecutors call to the stand Bentley, former Governor Bob Riley, heads of corporations and prominent lobbyists, powerful people from whom Hubbard asked for investments or help for his clients, according to prosecutors. Hubbard, age 54 and a native of Georgia, was elected to the Alabama House of Representatives in 1998 and later became minority leader in the House and chairman of the Alabama Republican Party. After the 2010 victory, Hubbard was elected as Speaker. In Alabama, the governor is not the most powerful politician. Many would argue the Speaker of the House is. If you are a strong Speaker, you are the Prime Minister because nothing gets around the Speaker, said Natalie Davis, a political scientist and pollster at Birmingham Southern College. We now move to the local section of the paper today. This article is headlined, Park District to Save Mowing Costs, and written by Allison Petty. Residents may notice grass in some neighborhood parks growing taller this summer, but it's not because the Decatur Park District forgot to mow. The district has chosen to reduce maintenance in some areas for financial and environmental reasons, officials said last week. Eventually, the plan is to introduce native plantings to create more natural ecosystems. Obviously, we save money on labor, on fuel, said Ryan Raleigh, Director of Operations. It also creates a better environmental aspect to the parks in helping with storm water runoff, reducing erosion. It creates habitats for animals and birds and things like that. Tall grasses also discourage the presence of geese, which can be a nuisance in neighborhood parks. The district will reduce mowing in portions of Baker Woods, Garmin, Oak Grove, Crest Haven, Greendale, Park Luis, Galloway, and Nelson Parks. Signs will soon denote those areas, and employees will keep a perimeter mowed. District employees will mow the natural areas every 4 to 6 weeks, rather than weekly, Raleigh said. Eventually, once the native plantings are installed, the district would mow just a few times a year. Other commitments are likely to prevent the district from adding the plantings this year. We've got other things that our people are in the middle of, so at this point we're just not going to have the time to do it this year, but we will in the future, Raleigh said. Executive Director Bill Clevenger said the concept of creating natural areas in some parks was outlined in the district's master plan. He emphasized that the benefits were two-pronged, and he hoped they would couple to benefit the district and the community as a whole. I think people jump to the immediate conclusion that the only reason you're doing this is to save money, and that's not necessarily the case, Clevenger said. We hope it will have a financial impact, but we are also certain that it will have environmental impact. Our next article from the local page is headlined New Millikan Grads Gift to the World, written by Tony Reed. Alexander Tuith crunched the numbers and came up with an answer that is serving him well. A Millikan University education really works. The Accounting and Information Systems double degree major was one of the 400-strong 2016 class graduating Sunday during commencement ceremonies at the Decatur Civic Center. Tuith, age 22, who grew up in Decatur, will allow himself a brief moment of celebration before heading off to State Farm's vast insurance campus in Bloomington to start his career as a business analyst. Truth said Millikan paved the way to success with a curriculum that educated him with work that actually mattered. He recalled participating in a project to create a database for Macon County's homeless population that will be used for years to come by those working to help them. So the work you do at Millikan has value, Truth said. It's not just you do it and they'll throw it aside. It's performance learning. Getting internships at the State Farm office helped boost Truth's employment performance prospects. And he said Millikan gave him skills that have value in the outside world. Information systems and accounting are huge nowadays, he added. These areas are growing rapidly, and there are lots of jobs. Commencement speaker Jennifer C. Friday said Millikan also provided her with the skills she needed to succeed when she graduated almost 40 years ago. Now she's an assistant professor at psychology at Georgia Gwinnett College and president of the Friday Consulting Group. She reminded Tuith and his fellow graduates that the School of Hard Knocks awaited them outside academia's gates. The difference between school and life is that school teaches you lessons and then gives you a test, she said. But life gives you tests and then you learn the lessons. You are about to begin the greatest learning experience of your life. Are you ready for the test? Because there will be many. Friday described the mortar-boarded heads looking up at her as the pretty bows atop gifts that the world is eager to open. She said it was up to the graduates to take all that their families and Millikan has given them and find a path allowing them to use their gifts to the best purpose. Seeking your way, she warned, means suffering the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune while persisting and not giving up. Fear keeps many of us from experiencing some of life's peak moments, she said. You need to say, world, here I am, take me. I have a lot to give. I am a gift to you. Go for it, class. The world awaits, and oh, the places that you'll go. Our next article from the local page is headlined, Virtual Zoo Takes Stevenson Students to the Animals, written by Valerie Wells. Live cameras are great when the animals cooperate. At Stevenson School on Friday, fifth grade students had a chance to explore the virtual zoo created by kindergarten teacher Jennifer Doyle for her own students, which she shared with all her students. With the help of six of her students' moms, she transformed her classroom into a jungle, complete with recorded jungle sounds. Along the walls were photos of animals such as tigers, koalas, and penguins, with codes next to them that kids can scan with their iPads. These codes take them to websites with animal facts or videos, and in some cases, live webcams. Sometimes the iPads didn't want to cooperate, so Doyle put the websites up on the Promethean board, including a San Diego Zoo webcam of their elephants. "What's he doing?" Doyle said, laughing as one of the elephants straddled a large rock in their enclosure and then scratched his tummy against it. Another webcam is focused on a pair of eagles, and students watched the two eaglets alone in the nest for a few minutes while their parents were out hunting for food. "I know everything there is to know about tigers," said Terrell Clark, who settled down on the floor in front of a photo of a tiger to scan the code. "You can't tell me anything I don't know." The fifth grader said he discovered an interest in tigers a couple of years ago and set out to learn everything that he could about them. But even so, he found information that he didn't know about them thanks to the virtual zoo. Jazra Ricks said it was fun to watch the animals on the webcam. "I'd like to go there and see them in person," she said. Doyle likes to do a big project to close out the year, and last year she took the students outdoors to collect insects for study. This year, she decided on the animals' theme, thanks to the iPad's availability. And though her room was decorated like a jungle, the animals' understudy also included ocean dwellers, grasslands, and Arctic creatures. "It was like kids and animals. What could be more perfect?" she said. And here is a brief report headlined "Girl 15 Dies in Crash" from Hinesboro. Police are investigating a Sunday afternoon accident near Hinesboro that claimed the life of a 15-year-old girl. The Douglas County Coroner's Office said that Amberlyn P. Humes of rural Oakland was pronounced dead at the scene at 2:32 p.m. The male driver of the vehicle reportedly later died after being taken to Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, although this could not be confirmed Sunday night. The coroner's office said Humes was in a vehicle with one other female and one other male occupant that was eastbound on County Road 300 North when it left the road just after 2 p.m. and rolled over several times, ejecting all three. Both the other female involved and the male were taken to Carl. The remaining survivor is understood to be in critical condition. The crash is being probed by the coroner's office, the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, and a crash reconstruction team from the Illinois State Police. Our next brief article is headlined "Loop Lake Bike Ride." The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Lake Volunteers Association are hosting the Loop Lake Shelbyville Bike Ride Saturday, June 11th. All rides will start from the Lake Shelbyville Visitor Center with registration from 7 to 8:30 a.m. and including a 22, 46, or 65-mile option. Proceeds benefit the association. Riders should return to the visitor center by 3:30 p.m. and must be older than 14. Anyone younger than 18 must be accompanied by an adult. Early registration is $25, and day of ride registration is $30. Register by Wednesday, May 25th to receive a T-shirt. Go to www.tinyurl.com/LakeShelbyville for a registration form. For more information, call the Lake Shelbyville Project Office at 217-774-3951, extension 2. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald Review for Monday, May 23rd, 2016. Please stay tuned.